News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Ihaeus Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The challenge we're having is that the political will is not there, especially from the presidency. There is no clear-cut directive on what to do.
That security analyst, Senator Eragbo, saying Nigerian authorities have moved too slowly to address general insecurity from insurgency and rampant kidnappings. Details coming up. Also, Ethiopia's prime minister says the third phase of the filling of the Grand Renaissance Dam is complete. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Rwanda yesterday, the third and final leg of the Africa tour. At each stop, Blinken stressed that the United States is seeking a true partnership with African countries, supports regional efforts to reduce violence, and is not trying to dictate with whom they should form alliances. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken completed his visit to Africa after holding talks Thursday with Rwandan President Paul Kagame in the capital, Kigali. Blinken told reporters he had raised serious concerns about human rights and called for an end to any support for armed rebels in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC.
There are very credible reports of support for armed groups by all sides, including the FDLR, by Congolese forces and M23, by Rwandans. And our position is clear. Whoever it's by, whoever it's to, that support needs to cease for any armed group.
A day earlier in Kinshasa, the capital of the DRC, Blinken voiced those same concerns that Rwanda has provided support to the armed rebel group operating in the east of the DRC, M23. The Congolese foreign minister had this to say.
This bed of the east of our country has been plagued by armed terrorist groups that sow terror, decimating our populations for over 20 years. It was against this backdrop that we had a bilateral exchange.
Secretary Blinken launched his three-nation tour last Sunday in South Africa, paying tribute to the Soweto Uprising, a student protest against the former apartheid regime. Blinken and his South African counterpart, Naledi Pandor, both said they had substantive and honest talks, focusing on common goals and interests. Addressing competition for influence on the continent with China and Russia, Blinken outlined the overarching theme of the trip.
What we seek most of all is a true partnership between the United States and Africa. We don't want an imbalanced or transactional relationship. And our commitment to a stronger partnership with Africa is not about trying to outdo anyone else.
Blinken's visit follows a tour of the continent by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and one expert told VOA she is not sure that Africans are convinced the U.S. is still not vying for influence on the continent. Elizabeth Shackelford is with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She spoke to VOA via Zoom.
I think that it's still coming across that this is all part of a big great power competition game, and that there's a little bit of FOMO if we aren't going to be there, that we're afraid of missing out on places that Russia and China are both really prioritizing.
Another expert told VOA he does see a change in tone and approach to Africa from the Biden administration. Tom Shee is with the United States Institute of Peace.
I think the difference here, though, is perhaps from the previous administration, the Biden administration isn't so much interested in telling Africans how they should conduct their business, with whom they should conduct their business. There was a rather pointed edge to the previous administration's message on China.
Elizabeth Shackelford told VOA she thinks the United States should prioritize African countries such as Kenya, which appears to be moving forward in a democratic direction after elections this week. And she does not feel the U.S. must show up everywhere on the continent to compete with others. Blinken visited Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal last November. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Kenyans voted last Tuesday to choose a new president, as well as senators, governors, lawmakers, women representatives, and some 1,500 county officials. Turnout was lower than in previous elections, and some Kenyans said they were keen to move on from the vote and resume normal life if only the presidential vote results were known. I asked VOA Africa 54 managing editor Vincent McCourty, who is in Nairobi monitoring the results, to first talk about the general mood in the country.
Well, here in Nairobi, where I am at the moment, and I'm hearing from the rest of the country, people are growing tense. You see, the longer the process stretches, the more people get anxious because they start wondering what's going on. And, you know, there is now people start feeling, you know, filling the gaps, sometimes with rumor, speculation. And of course, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation. So generally, while many patient, they're waiting, they're giving the Electoral Commission their time to do their job. There are those who are growing very, very impatient at this point as we speak.
The big news today is Kenya media have stopped broadcasting provincial results of the country's presidential poll, raising questions over the outcome of the vote as the counting process is entering the fourth day. Could you tell us a little about that?
You know, the thing is, right from the beginning, the television stations were releasing the numbers, the vote numbers for the presidential race, for members of parliament, and people are getting used to kind of going along with it, tabulating as they go along with the TV stations here, the media houses. So for some reason, suddenly yesterday night, they stopped doing so. There hasn't been a very clear explanation as to why. And here in Kenya, usually when such a thing happens, people start wondering, is this an indicator that maybe there's something going on? Or is there some possibility that the Electoral Commission has stopped giving access to the media houses to get the necessary information? So that has created another debate altogether. And it's not usually a very pleasant kind of scenario for many of the Kenyans. But, you know, the Electoral Commission chairman is saying, look, we want you to get the most accurate numbers, and those ones only come from us, and we have not verified all, and we haven't certified all the results. So until that happens, we will not give you the total numbers. Meanwhile, they are releasing the results from the different polling centers across the country in order to kind of comply with the law that the chairman has to release results from each polling center. And only once they finish will they give you the total number and declare who wins this election.
So, Vincent, the Kenya Election Committee Chairman Wafulu Chibukati has urged Kenyans not to worry about different outcomes projected by various TV channels. Has that helped?
To some degree. Some are actually going along with him because they're saying, what are we supposed to make of this various results that are being projected by the different media houses? Because that was also creating a lot of confusion. If you watched one station, they will show you Raila is ahead by a certain percentage, but at the very same time, you watch a different station, it will show you that Mr. William Ruto is leading by a certain margin. So that was creating all sorts of scenarios where people are just confused, others are almost starting to celebrate, others are crying. So the chairman said, look, we have all the numbers, the information is with us, and once we release it, you will come to realize that it's all the same. So stop looking at what is shown on this television. You still have to say, though, that, you know, Kenyans have a hard time sometimes believing in the Electoral Commission. They give them benefit of doubt. But the Electoral Commission of Kenya has had a history of bungling up the election, or at least being accused of having, you know, some errors, serious issues in the past election. So not everybody believes in the Electoral Commission, but a great number of people have spoken to say, well, we want to give them a benefit of doubt. And remember, the Electoral Commission, you know, the chairman reminded everybody, it has up to 7 days to announce the election results.
That is VOA's Africa 54 managing editor Vincent Makori, who is in Nairobi monitoring the Kenyan election results. He talked to me from Nairobi. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says the third phase filling of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, GERD, is complete. The announcement came a day after Ethiopia launched electricity production from the second turbine at the massive hydroelectric project. The French news agency AFP says there is still no agreement between Ethiopia and its downstream neighbors, Egypt and Sudan, about GERD's operations, despite talks held under the auspices of the African Union. Cairo and Khartoum view it as a threat because of their dependence on Nile waters, while Ethiopia deems it essential for the electrification and development of Africa's second most populous nation. Yesterday, Abiy sought to reassure the two countries about the dam's impact and called for negotiations to reach an understanding. Ethiopia first began generating electricity from the GERD in February. Currently, the two turbines, out of a total of 13, have a capacity to generate 750 megawatts of electricity. It's ultimately expected to produce more than 5,000 megawatts, more than doubling Ethiopia's current output. According to project manager Kifle Horo, the overall dam is now more than 80% complete, with a goal to finish it in the next 2.5 years. Nigeria's Air Force says airstrikes this week killed 55 members of criminal gangs who were involved in abduction for ransom operations. An Air Force spokesman says after the airstrikes, the militants released people they were holding hostage. Nigeria's government has come under heavy criticism for failing to stop mass abductions and Islamist militant attacks. Timothy Obiezu has more from Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The Nigerian Air Force says airstrikes in north central Kaduna State on Tuesday killed 28 members of a kidnapping for ransom gang, including a gang leader. It says many others were injured. Air Force Public Relations Director Gabriel Gapquet told reporters that authorities had received intelligence that bandits were gathering in the area. He said the success of the raid led to the release of captives held by the bandits. Gapquet said other airstrikes in northwestern Katsina State this week killed 27 bandits. He did not take calls from VOA for further comment. The airstrikes come a week after Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari presided over a national security meeting and said he had given security forces the full freedom to deal with terrorists. Darlington Abdullahi, president of the Alumni Association of Nigeria's National Defense College, says the president's words were a morale booster for troops.
This kind of thing should not come as a surprise. All you need is the political will to guide the action of the forces. I think they're getting probably that support that is required to deal with the situation. From the utterances of Mr. President.
But Gapquet said the military has also been conducting air operations targeting insurgents in northeastern Borno State. He said that included an August 6th raid in the village of Gazuwa that followed intelligence that terrorists from Boko Haram and splinter group Islamic State West Africa Province, ISWAP, were fighting each other. Nigeria has been fighting an Islamist insurgency in the northeast for more than 12 years. Authorities have been heavily criticized for failing to address general insecurity that stems from the insurgency and rampant kidnapping. Abdullahi says the military must stay on the offensive.
As long as this continues, I think the military still has opportunity to take on them before they organize themselves properly. I think the security agencies really have to continue the efforts, you know, to deal with the situation decisively.
Earlier this week, police said they had arrested four suspects connected to a church attack in the southwest state of Ondo that killed 40 worshippers. But security analyst Senator Irebu says authorities have shown a lack of political will to address the problem far too long.
The challenge we're having is that the political will is not there, especially from the presidency. There is no clear-cut directive on what to do. Anytime you hear that it's sounding frustrated, they keep on pushing the blame to others, not taking responsibility, not taking charge.
In July, Islamic State West Africa province claimed responsibility for a jailbreak in Abuja that freed over 400 inmates, including high-profile terrorism detainees. Only a few of the prisoners have since been recaptured. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Observers say the futures of Tunisia and President Kais Saied may depend on several factors, from whether the president can secure and sell a crucial International Monetary Fund rescue loan and its tough austerity requirements to save the deteriorating economy, to the calculations of powerful players such as the main trade union and the armed forces. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed whether the Tunisian president could succeed in balancing these crucial factors with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington. We'll have that file coming up next. But first, in Angola, Adalberto Costa Jr., leader of the opposition party UNITA, denies he has accepted funds from the family of late President José Eduardo dos Santos. The French news agency AFP says the charge was made by President João Lourenço of the ruling party MPLA, the People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola. He said this week it was hypocritical of the opposition to accuse his government of failing to curb corruption. He said the opposition, in his words, eat from the same plate of some of Dos Santos's children who left the country after being charged with corruption and money laundering. The national secretary of Costa's junior's party, UNITA, the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, called the allegations a political game. Lourenço and Costa Jr. face off in presidential elections on August 24th. We'll go back to what we were talking about. Observers say the future of Tunisia and President Kais Saied may depend on several factors, from whether the president can secure and sell a crucial International Monetary Fund rescue loan. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed whether the Tunisian president could succeed in balancing these crucial factors. Here's the report.
Well, the poll is correct. And Tunisians are losing faith in democracy. And they're sort of right about that, because democracies in and of themselves don't produce economic growth. You have to produce economic growth in the context of democracy, but it involves independent actions beyond just democracy. Now, the reasons for the Tunisian revolution of 2011 were more economic than political, that the actions of the government seemed to be moving in the direction of more politics than economics, and that if Tunisia didn't take care of the economic crises, focused on that more than the political side. I also have spent a lot of time over the years questioning young Tunisians and young Arabs about their views on democracy. And the question I often say, which democracy? Democracies like in Scandinavian countries or in Europe that are sponsor their citizens, or these sort of other democracies that we get in our part of the world that aren't really democratic? And I think that's a question here too. Like, how do you get a democracy that's also a kind of social democracy, which people want, a democracy that's responsive to the socioeconomic needs of people? Now, we know direct democracy, which is what Tunisians are sort of moving towards now, has always failed in human history, whether in Greece or in Libya next door or other places around the world, because when you have the population reporting directly to an autocrat at the top, it never really works. What works politically is groups of people with interests developing policy alternatives and then winning the popular support. And that can only happen in a representative democracy. Now, how do economics work? Economics work with strong laws and policies, and Tunisia failed to deliver those. But you also, through those, have to develop strong economic institutions, strong central banks, strong banking sector, and then you have to develop a strong private sector with public sector supports, which often means public sector regulating, but also getting out of the way. And so the solution here is to get back to a representative democracy that cares about the economy. And Tunisians will figure that out sooner or later.
Crucial is what happens next in Tunisia, given that it would carry important lessons in a region where every other Arab Spring experiment has failed.
Well, it's hugely important. Tunisia was a symbol across the world, not just across the Arab and Muslim world. Now, it wasn't the first democracy in the Muslim world. There have been others, but it was the most successful Arab democracy. It lasted 10 years. It got the Freedom House ranking of one. It did reach that and maintained it for several years. Now, why did Tunisia have a revolution? It happened for a lot of reasons, but one was it was a country with a large middle class, larger than other Arab countries. But the conditions are different now, and the middle class is shrinking. I also should say that Libya and Tunisia are very interlinked. So we have to spend a lot of time thinking about how political progress in Libya, and there's been some, will help Tunisia, and how political progress in Tunisia, including returning to the democratic path, will help Libya. And everyone's watching what the United States and the international community are doing vis-a-vis Tunisia's democratic reversal. And that's something that Austin got right, but the U.S. government in Washington got things wrong too, like with the Summit of Democracy, where it did exclude Tunisia, but it included Tunisian NGOs that had supported the coup. But ultimately, the only way to fix Tunisia is to force Saeed out. And how you get Saeed out will be a lesson for the Arab and Muslim world. So the more democratic way you get him out, i.e. a popular effort to push him out, is better than other ways, like coups and soft coups. So once the Tunisian population, which has dropped from about 75 to 80% support for Saeed to about 25 to 30% support for Saeed, but they're still not out in the street. Once they realize what has happened and that a single individual has grabbed control of their entire government and isn't going to be the savior that delivers them economic results, they're going to have to force him out and they're going to have to take action, and it will be collective action. And that's probably the best way to go. And it worked in 2010-11, and it will work again if enough people go out.
That was William Lawrence speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.